The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Best Practice Initial Treatment of SLE and GCA is presented by Dr. Janine Martin.
So thank you for having me here. I appreciate it. My name is Janine Martin. I also trained with Dr. DiGiovanni. I don't know if the volume's okay. And we're going to talk a little bit about best practices in the initial treatment of lupus, and then we'll get to GCA, which is giant cell arteritis, known to many as temporal arteritis. Just to review a little bit of what's been going on in the South, I'm from right outside of New Orleans, so you can see in the top, I guess that'll be your left corner, is the most recent storm, Nate. We've had a lot of activity, and I thought it was interesting as I was typing up my third revision of this lecture during that storm. And then I also trained in the bottom left corner. You can see St. Petersburg and Tampa was affected by Irma. Anyone from those areas that's made it today, we're happy to have you and hope your families are well. Okay, you can't do much with lupus without first talking about some of the classification. This is the 1997 classification, which most people are familiar with, involved the malar rash, discoid rash, photosensitivity, oral ulcers, non-erosive arthritis, pleurisy, pericarditis, some renal parameters, which was greater than half a gram per day, 3+ proteinuria on a dipstick or cellular casts, neurologic disorders, which was left somewhat vague, and in the later slides you'll see we've adjusted slightly, with seizures or psychosis with the absence of another cause. Hematologic disorders, which you do set parameters for, leukopenia is less than 4,000 per millimeter cube, lymphopenia under 1,500, and thrombocytopenia less than 100,000. There were two immunologic. One is that you had a positive ANA, but further was, do you have these other markers such as a double-stranded DNA antibody, anti-Smith antibody, which is very specific for lupus. The anti-cardiolipin, if it was an IgG or IgM, which I know that's being seen more frequently, I try not to say commercial, but some of the commercial, more common labs, you'll start seeing that they're going to send you an IgG, an IgA, or an IgM, if you see those. False positive RPR with a confirmation negative treponemal. And then in 2012, they really didn't change the criteria, they just reorganized it. And tried to expand it because we thought we were missing people. Maybe patients that at some point, I think this goes backward. If we just say malar rash and discoid rash, we don't really talk about subacute cutaneous lupus or discoid lupus. We just said these two things. I mean, not discoid, I'm sorry, lupus tumidus or some of these other types of rashes. So, pardon. With this, the update tried to do was to give a broader definition so we could catch people earlier for lupus. One was that biopsy-positive lupus nephritis with a positive ANA or just a positive double-stranded DNA was the sole criterion. If you have lupus nephritis, you have lupus. And that kind of went without saying, but we didn't clearly state that. The immunologic criteria didn't really change much, except you see the mention of a complement, C3 or C4. We use these as markers similar to sedimentation rates or C-reactive proteins as a sign of possible activity in lupus. So to not include that made it very difficult when you see someone who looked like they possibly had the disease but never quite made the criteria. So that helps include some more people. The direct Coombs in the absence of hemolytic anemia. And the other ones is that we just broadened a lot of the clinical scenarios. So acute cutaneous lupus could include a lot of these various skin manifestations that maybe weren't mentioned in the 97 criteria. You also had a chronic cutaneous lupus, oral and nasal ulcerations, non-scarring alopecia, synovitis. Some of these, you know, they really didn't change. The neurologic did broaden, and it was seizure, psychosis, but also mononeuritis multiplex, transverse myelitis, confusional state, which I think all disorders probably can include a confusional state somewhere, or it's much like fatigue, it's elusive. But it's certainly worth watching in this population. And then the leukopenia and thrombocytopenia. On both of these, it requires four. And the first, it would be out of 11, and on this one, it's four, one immunologic, one clinical. These are the quick mnemonics. They always help. The soap brain MD, I always like that one. And then there was this one, which I was not aware of until making this presentation, which is rash on scalp, to help you kind of remember what we're looking for. I got the lupus lecture, and I kind of laughed because it's a really difficult disease. It's a broad disease, involves a lot of organs. Do we have a single treatment algorithm? No. Basically, we went after, when we study lupus, we go after those life or organ-threatening diseases, and we try to design a treatment around that particular organ. So it's typically based on that. The 1999 guideline for referral and the management of lupus was a general guideline that was published, and it sort of helped internists when to refer, what to be watching for, how early should we be sending people to a rheumatologist, and had some basic guidelines about blood pressure control and things like this. It did talk about some of the drugs. 2010, EULAR, which is the European Rheumatology Society, had recommendations for neuropsychiatric lupus. In 2012, the ACR put out the lupus nephritis guidelines, which was a neat way of, we'd already been using a lot of these drugs to treat lupus nephritis, but we had never had a consensus statement to sort of say, this is how we're gonna do first line, second line, until we had remission. EULAR followed quickly behind with theirs. Very few changes, except in dosing. And then a more recent article was Treat to Target. This was an international consortium between United States and other countries to say, do we have a target? Is there something we can treat to target in 2014? The two primary questions they asked themselves is, do we actually have one? How do you treat something that has a changing target? And how do we actually define remission in lupus? So with this, the goals for treatment is always looking for remission, no disease activity. And if not possible, then certainly the lowest possible activity. We do have validated measures for lupus. I do not go into detail on a lot of them because I find that most of them are not relevant clinically, but more for study inclusions, follow-up, morbidity studies. But the two that I find very helpful is a SLIC or a Selena SLEDAI. These can be very helpful. There's some clinical data, there's some laboratory data that go into these, and they're quite easy to find, but they're also built into a lot of the EMRs now. The other is organ-specific markers. So if you have a patient that's had lupus pneumonitis and their PFTs suddenly decline, or they have pulmonary arterial hypertension and something's changed in their DLCO, or a right heart cath that's showing elevation in pressures, and a urine protein and creatinine ratio, these are really good markers to let you know where you stand. One of our goals is to try to restrict any of the irreversible damage. And another one that they brought to the forefront was to maintain quality of life, which is a lot of times harder or easier said than done. But I think it's important that we address this with lupus patients. They, more often than not, are young women. This is during their childbearing years. There's a lot of conversations that need to be had. And in addition to quality of life, one of the big guiding principles of this particular task force was that the patient needs to be engaged, and they need to be informed, and they need to be a part of their decision-making team, because a lot of the things we ask them is a little daunting to process. And they don't always want to jump on your recommendations initially. So having a good line of communication is really important with lupus, probably with every patient. You have to choose your therapy based on severity of disease. And again, like I said, there's just never one target. This was 11 basic treat-to-target recommendations. So we had a group of the brightest minds come together, and they narrowed us down to 11. I still think that's a lot when you're trying to find targets in a patient, but that gives you an idea of how broad this disease can be. So remission, prevention of flares, so the fewer times, and I think Aaron had mentioned this, trying to prevent these flares, this low level of activity that recurs over time can cause more damage in the long run. This is an interesting one. It was recommended that if a patient is asymptomatic but continues to have persistent serologies, that it is not required to escalate treatment. We treat patients, we don't treat their labs. And that's really important. They're going to have a double-stranded DNA, it's probably not going away. The ANA will fluctuate on you, but you have to trust some of your other measures to know when it's time to escalate and when it's time to be as conservative with your medication. Prevent damage. Fatigue needs to be addressed. Pain, which is difficult at times to address, and depression should also. Early diagnosis, particularly of renal disease. So the recommendation there, and what I do is every 3 months, I do get a urine sample from all patients that are either ANA positive and concerning or already diagnosed with lupus. They hate it, and I still make them do it because it's a good indicator along with their labs that things aren't going on or something's not being detected. Lupus nephritis treatment should continue for about 3 years. There's a debate on length of treatment and maintenance and when to withdraw medications. Their recommendation was 3. Some people say 2. Antiphospholipid needs to be treated. It's about 16% of lupus patients will have antiphospholipid syndrome. And irrespective of any other treatment that we may decide as rheumatologists, they should all be on an antimalarial like hydroxychloroquine. If they can tolerate it and they're not allergic to it, they should be on it. The relevant therapies is where I think on the next slide you'll see. These are the questions of now as internal medicine physicians and primary care providers, what all do we need to be looking for? There is no clear statement coming from the ACR or from rheumatologists for a lot of these, but we do know this. SLE is a considered a coronary vascular disease equivalent, should be treated as such, so we do need to watch these patients. Leading cause of death in lupus, particularly late lupus now, is actually cardiovascular. It used to be infection from all the prednisone, it's now cardiovascular. All lupus patients with nephritis should be treated with an ACE or an ARB, or if proteinuria is greater than a half a gram in 24 hours. If you're looking at a patient who doesn't have lupus nephritis but does have SLE, might be a good choice of a antihypertensive medication. Targets are less than 130 over 80. As long as they're non-diabetics, that's level A evidence. Statin therapy for LDL greater than 100. This is a hard one because on the other half of my day, I get the referrals for the statin myopathy. So it's a tough one to on one side be recommending statins on my patients and at the other side saying, well, maybe that's what's causing your muscle aches and pains. But they do have a role. We all know that. And then bone density, depending on the amount of steroids they're on and their age criteria, we should be keeping up on these. A lot of times they are younger and it's not on our radar to make sure they're getting a bone density. But if their prednisone doses are 7.5 milligrams or greater, they're at a significant risk in a very short period of time to be developing osteoporosis. I actually found the original article. When we talk about medications that are FDA indicated for lupus, that's the list. That's all. That's all of them right there. And I think that's always been the trouble with lupus is finding great drugs. Even good drugs would be nice sometimes. 1948, aspirin was approved by the FDA for systemic lupus. 1955, which is this diagram on the side, was for Medicortin. It was the approval of prednisone, or steroids, for the use in systemic lupus. By 1955, we had also had hydroxychloroquine. And then 2011, we had Benlysta. It's been a very difficult drug to establish a good randomly controlled trial. What parameters do we watch for? If it's a pulmonary arterial hypertension, that's a different style than what you would use for lupus nephritis. So this becomes very difficult to get drugs approved. So the standard medications here, you can read through them, and I do talk about a few of them because I think it's nice to know what drugs, when your patients come to see you, what are they on, what does that drug interact with? So I did a little bit of a review on these. NSAIDs, corticosteroids, antimalarials, azathioprine, methotrexate, and mycophenolate, those are probably the most common you'll see. Cyclophosphamide certainly is there, Benlysta. And the asterisk shows the ones that are mostly case reports, small conflicting studies, but nothing that gave us convincing evidence, but we do use them. And the ones with the plus sign are the ones that have FDA indications. So this is an interesting picture since we were in DC. This is the 1915 laying of the Lincoln Memorial's cornerstone. And I like to think of Plaquenil in that way, or hydroxychloroquine. It is commonly our first line in mild lupus, particularly if it's arthritis and skin only, or if it's a milder case, it's a great choice of drug, it's well tolerated. Even if the patient is on other medications, we still encourage this, as I said before. It can take 6 weeks for response. The literature says about 4 months. I always just usually say it's going to be about 12 weeks. We'll see how you respond to it. If you're not allergic, then we'll start seeing if you're having any relief with your skin manifestations or with your joints. It has shown itself to prevent flares. And so in that case, what we did was they did a study with low serum levels of hydroxychloroquine, meaning patients were non-adherent, and they had an increased risk of flares when they were studied over time. Positive effect on it has a positive effect on lipid profiles in lupus patients, can also play a role in reducing cardiovascular and thrombotic risk. It has a slight antiplatelet activity, but long term it does seem to help decrease overall inflammation, which is, as we know, a proponent of coronary artery disease. Retinopathy is the biggest side effect that we do have to watch for. Generally, we get a baseline visual field exam, and then they can follow those up annually. That recommendation comes from us. It also comes from the American Association of Ophthalmology. I am not going to talk too much about the mechanisms, but if people are interested in them, I put them there. So I will kind of move through these. But an interesting thing is cigarette smoking can actually decrease or interfere with the response of an antimalarial. So that's something you want to watch for. Hemolytic anemia in G6PD deficient patients. It's not that common in the population, but because it's a lot easier to get this test approved now, I do recommend doing it before all patients are started on this. The next would be nonsteroidals, indications again, just arthritis, myalgia, sericitis, and a headache. There's plenty of options to choose from based on other morbidities to best guide your patient on these. I do watch renal and hepatic function. I notice a lot of times patients come in and maybe they haven't had labs in 6 months to a year because they're relatively healthy, but because we prescribe so many nonsteroidals, I actually do check this every 3 to 4 months to make sure, because I'd rather catch something earlier than later. It can actually cause an aseptic meningitis in higher doses, so you do need to watch for that as well. Corticosteroids, this is what everyone thinks we do for the most part. When we talk about rheumatology, steroids are really a lot of this, and when it comes to lupus, that used to be the mainstay of therapy. It does decrease inflammation. And in mild to moderate systemic lupus and cutaneous disease, it can help. 5 to 30 milligrams or an equivalent dose of prednisone. You can do single or divided doses as tolerated. With the higher ones tending to be in the early part of disease or diagnosis to get things under control, and the lower ones being more of the maintenance. So 5 milligrams or below is usually my goal. That's not always possible. With severe organ involvement, such as nephritis or pneumonitis, hematologic abnormalities, CNS disease or systemic vasculitis, this is when we talk about a high dose of prednisone, which would be 1 to 2 mg per kg per day. You have to watch these due to a lot of side effects, particularly steroid psychosis, which can get kind of difficult. Also, pulse therapy, this is when we're really talking about life-threatening diseases, is 1 gram daily for 3 days. And that's the general question, when do you pulse a patient? And the general rule of thumb, which I learned from my senior fellows in training, was if it's a life or organ threatening event, it's time to pulse them. And so you can see a lot of those there. Azathioprine, again, I put all of the mechanisms there, but I think the important things to know about this is it can be used during pregnancy. So in lupus nephritis, if you do have a pregnant patient, this might be the only drug we have other than steroids for an induction. We hope we don't have those situations, but they do occur. Milder cases of lupus pneumonitis, it can be effective, as well as what I like to term lupoid hepatitis. It's a little bit antiquated, but it differentiates it from autoimmune hepatitis, which actually also can be treated quite well with azathioprine. And again, just the typical labs. A few things to know about azathioprine is a TPMT deficiency. I don't order it because it's very difficult to get it paid for. So, in certain patients, they can't process this drug very well. What is important with azathioprine is it can potentiate with allopurinol. So that's a good one to watch med lists for when patients are on this. I see it happen a lot, is that you need to adjust both of these drugs in order for them to be taking at the same time. Methotrexate, this is probably one of the drugs we use the most of. It's a dihydrofolic acid analog, which inhibits the reductase enzyme for that. There are no great trials that convincingly said this helps in systemic lupus, while we have excellent data that shows that methotrexate can halt the progression in rheumatoid arthritis. We aren't fortunate enough to have these kind of studies, but I do still think it's very effective. There are plenty of studies there that suggest that it can be effective in the arthritis that is associated with lupus. It also can help with a lot of the skin manifestations. It's well tolerated by patients. Its options are oral or intramuscular, mostly it's sub-Q, but there are some GI complaints. It can cause some oral ulcerations. You can kind of work your way around those sometimes. You do have to watch liver enzymes. They do have to restrict alcohol. There is a pneumonitis, although rare, it can be life-threatening. And this can happen at any time in the course of a methotrexate therapy. So a patient comes who's been on methotrexate for some stable disease, whether it's rheumatoid or lupus or psoriatic or whatever, just know that this is a nice little tool to put in your back pocket. They can develop this pneumonitis at any time, so an increasing shortness of breath, hypoxia, could be coming from their methotrexate. It is teratogenic, so I have to be very careful with this drug in my younger population. With males, it's a little bit easier, but we do want them to wait before trying to start a family. We do check labs on that one as well. Cyclophosphamide, again, I know this part of it can get kind of boring. So it's an alkylating agent. The things I wanted to know is this is generally used for severe life-threatening drugs. And when we talk about best therapies or recommendations, it's considered standard of care to use cyclophosphamide in lupus nephritis, lupus pneumonitis, and alveolar hemorrhage, active and worsening pulmonary arterial hypertension. Except the only one that actually has a level A evidence is lupus nephritis. And I think it's quite interesting when you're studying and working with a disease like this that you have no FDA indications and you're working to try to find best practices. But the best evidence for all the other ones was level C. So a lot of this does come from experience. And we do rely on our colleagues for a lot of advice, experience, things they've seen or done. As far as the cyclophosphamide infertility, and that's why I said the patient needs to be involved in the conversation when we're talking about these drugs, because we are changing their story and their life, and I think that becomes very important when you talk about these with young women and men. We can try with Lupron or testosterone for the men to prevent infertility, but that does become a problem. And if it is a life-threatening situation or you're in the hospital, the time it would take for the Lupron to be effective has already passed. So when you're deciding to do these drugs, a lot of times they are a bit blindsided with a lot of information. We still use Mesna to prevent any hemorrhagic cystitis. CellCept, which I think is a really well-tolerated drug, is as effective as cyclophosphamide for short-term remission in lupus nephritis, and is now currently a part of the 2002 guidelines as the preferred drug for Hispanics and African Americans. So a drug with a much better safety profile, a little bit easier to get patients to take, has showing great data with regard to lupus nephritis. IVIG I don't use much with regard to lupus, but it does neutralize circulating myelin antibodies, can be helpful in certain scenarios, particularly lupus pneumonitis seems to have the better of the data. You want to avoid this in IgA deficient patients, it's still a pooled blood product. Rituximab is a B cell inhibiting drug that because the systemic lupus was felt to so strongly be B cell driven, the idea that Rituxan would be effective was almost a given. We thought for sure this drug will work. Did some very large trials, the LUNAR trial, the EXPLORER trial, and unfortunately what we found is it didn't show statistically significant over placebo, which was very disappointing actually for this drug because it has been effective. That being said, there are plenty of cases. I think most rheumatologists in this room can agree with me that this drug has proven to be a great second and even third line drug for certain connective tissue diseases, including lupus. There are plenty of open label reports there to support us and our choice of using this. There was another CD22, another B cell inhibitor that had the same anticipation of a great success. It was eprotizumab, and it also sort of fell flat in the initial trials. They're still trying to revive it now to see if there are certain indications or if they had built the population better. Other targets continue to be attempted with limited success because it is just a difficult disease and there are difficult targets to establish a good study to show statistical significance for. Belimumab is Benlysta. It's kind of the new kid. It was a big deal when this came out. It was 50 years since the last FDA indicated drug. While it does work with B cells, it's working with their activating factor, and that was known as BAF, or a B cell stimulator known as BLyS, and they modulate B cell survival. It is part of a TNF superfamily, and if that isn't on the top of your head, that is Humira and Enbrel. These are TNFs, tumor necrosis factor inhibitors. It showed most improved in patients with high double-stranded DNA or a low C3. Two trials, they were the BLyS 52 and the BLyS 76. It was standing for 52 weeks and 76 weeks. Other criteria were pretty much the same in both groups, and they achieved significantly better results than their placebo. There's a significant a follow-up study that showed a significant delay in time from the first SLE flare versus placebo. And it also led to a significant reduction in steroid doses in the 52-week trial, which was very promising. And I find the drug very well tolerated by patients, well covered by insurance, which becomes harder and harder these days, and relatively easy to manage. These are just a few tables that show some of the medications and what we're all doing, because a lot of this is level C or just experience. And so I picked a few out of a very long, exhaustive list of what are we using first and in what diseases to try to reach that remission. For constitutional symptoms, it's glucocorticoids, hydroxychloroquine, and methotrexate, or some combination therein. We also still use mycophenolate in those scenarios. And third line, meaning more aggressive, would be Rituxan or belimumab. For non-erosive, non-deforming arthritis, Plaquenil, I was redundant there. It's plus or minus glucocorticoids, and I'll correct that. Second line induction for methotrexate, and third line would be rituximab. Lupus pericarditis has glucocorticoids and Plaquenil. I actually use a lot of colchicine in those scenarios, and it seems to help. If it's refractory, though, then you may want to add in other treatments like mycophenolate, azathioprine, methotrexate. Discoid lupus, again, hydroxychloroquine. And you can also try azathioprine, things like this. And the list, you can kind of read through some of those because it starts to sound repetitive, but when you only have a few drugs, it's the right, finding the right combination in the right patient, and being willing to move these drugs around while you're watching them. So the other part of this talk, which is a little bit quicker, is best practices for giant cell arteritis, which I know everybody sees because it's rather common. It's the most common primary systemic vasculitis in adults over the age of 50. It is a large vessel vasculopathy. Persistent inflammation can either lead to stenosis or it can lead to an aneurysm. And there was this great talk, and I think Dr. DiGiovanni will remember, of Dr. Seo used to say the vessel has two choices. It can either fight back and stenose, or it can give up and it'll cause an aneurysm. He's in trouble. Visual loss is about 10% of cases. There's a relapses in 50% when 50% of patients will relapse when you begin the taper. And that's a significant number. In North America, it's about 15 to 20% of polymyalgia rheumatica will have a coexistent giant cell arteritis. So I think we need to ask these questions of patients who we initially just think are PMRs, and we've got the diagnosis locked up, is to make sure we ask about a headache, jaw claudication, changes in their voice, changes in their vision. It really doesn't take much time to just run through those. And it's about 40 to 60% of giant cell arteritis patients that have coexistent PMR, so the reverse being true there. But usually they end up on steroids and they never complain about their shoulders or their hips. There are criteria. It's pretty much what we said. Age over 50, new onset of headache, temporal artery abnormality, elevated SED rate, typically greater than 50 millimeters per hour, and some abnormal, an abnormal artery biopsy. And that was for the purposes of classification. Prednisone still remains the gold standard of medications, and that's typically started at 1 milligram per kilogram of body weight per day, typically somewhere around 60 milligrams initially. For high-risk patients, I have seen some cases where people will pulse them at, particularly if the patient is already complaining of visual loss or if there's an ophthalmologist involved and we are seeing signs of some kind of optic neuritis, it wouldn't be without reason to go ahead and pulse this patient to get everything under control. Once the CRP are reduced by 50%, you can begin to wean. I actually don't follow this, which is from the ACR site. I actually follow more of a BSR guidelines. This is the British Society of Rheumatology. And it was the same as far as the initiating dose, 40 to 60 milligrams. The dose can be reduced once the lab abnormalities resolve. So I generally wait for the ESR and the CRP to completely normalize before I start weaning my prednisone, and I find that works well for me. And then you can follow this other step where you decrease by 10 milligrams every 2 to 4 weeks to 20 milligrams. Once you reach 20 milligrams, you go in increments of 2.5 milligrams every 2 to 4 weeks. And once you reach 10 milligrams, you decrease by 1 milligram per month or even 2 months. Aspirin was felt that this was necessary to prevent any thrombotic events or ischemic events. 81 to 150 milligrams of aspirin is suggested, but there's no random controlled trials to support this, but a lot of us do it, and a lot of these patients are already on aspirin, so I think that helps. Methotrexate is recommended, although not indicated. It reduces relapse rates by 35% in one study. It was a meta-analysis that methotrexate, somewhere between 7.5 and 15 milligrams per week, can allow for a cumulative reduction in steroid within 48 weeks. I do use this drug, and I do find it helpful for a lot of patients. They continued to find other drugs as Remicade and other medications were coming out, and not a lot of them really were found to be helpful. There are some case studies for TNF inhibitors like Remicade, Humira. A few of them tried. You might be aware that rituximab or Rituxan was indicated for ANCA vasculitis, so why wouldn't it work for this one? It does sometimes, but it wasn't strong enough data to get any indication. But I do see cases that is helpful. What's been really interesting is this interleukin 6 inhibition in a drug by the name of Actemra, which has been out for quite some time with regard to rheumatoid arthritis. But we started to see data that IL-6 inhibition could help in vasculitis. We had begun using this off-label in my fellowship training, actually, for certain vasculitides. And as of May this year, 2017, it did receive its FDA indication for giant cell arteritis. Patients tolerate it well. We're not seeing a lot of infections. You do have to monitor the patients, but this seems to be very effective in getting steroid doses down and if not off. The newest drug is Kevzara. It is another IL-6 inhibitor, and I was able to speak with their clinical liaison. And the plans will be, they've recently launched for rheumatoid arthritis, but the plan will be to have a trial in the future for giant cell. So I anticipate this drug will also be approved in the future. No, I don't believe.
Okay. Well, I think that was a very good review, and you know, particularly the lupus was excellent. Exhaustive, I think, is exhaustive or exhausting. I don't know. We'll open it up to some questions for our two panel members. I know there's some. I see some rheumatologists in the audience too. They can chime in if they have some experience and would like to add to anything.
My question is actually kind of off topic, but it's kind of about in an outpatient setting, when you have a patient who has lupus, RA, any of the number of things that have them on methotrexate or others, when it comes to giving them live virus vaccines, how do you feel about zoster? Because they obviously are at high risk for zoster, and yet are they going to be able to mount the response? Are they going to get sick from the vaccine? Like, how is the best way to approach that?
Would any of you care to handle that, or do you want me to?
Either.
Sure, go ahead.
I ran away from the podium so Dr. DiGiovanni would answer them, but with the vaccines, as long as they are non-live, so that would be pneumococcal and the influenza, it's fine. They may have a bit of a blunted response, including on methotrexate, as well as all the biologics, so that would be Orencia, Remicade, Humira, Enbrel. I classify them as my fancy drugs. If you see one of our fancy drugs on there, they should not be getting a live vaccine, but that includes methotrexate. The zoster is definitely one we'd like. I'm catching a lot of these. They go to the clinics outside, not your clinic. They're going to the drugstore clinic, and they're getting the zoster vaccine. They should not be getting those without us holding the drug for a while. They could potentially be affected. So we ask that you try to hold those, try to warn them to come talk to us, and we'll set it up. At least that's how I'm doing it. Any other vaccines y'all can think of?
Well, of course, the flu mist is a live attenuated virus, so you don't want to use that. And then you may have seen that there was the Zostervax that we have now is a live attenuated vaccine. I think it's in the nature of 60% or so effective. So last year, I mean, I'm old enough now to get that vaccine, even though I don't take immunosuppressives. But last year, you may have seen one of the November issues of New England Journal, and I'm not sure if it's Merck or not, but they have a viral subunit zoster vaccine that's juiced up with adjuvant, you know. So adjuvants just, you know, non-specifically enhance your immune response. So it came out that it was like 97-98% effective. And then apparently it was on, there's a guy who has a website out of Texas, a rheumatologist by the name of John Cush, and my fellows like to follow his website because he's got pretty cutting edge stuff on there. And it turns out that the advisory committee to the FDA unanimously approved this new vaccine a couple of weeks ago. So it should be out like any day, and when it is, I'm getting it. And being a viral subunit, you know, it should be safe, but it's got a lot of adjuvant, it's really juiced up with adjuvant. So will that make any of these autoimmune diseases flare up? I don't know yet, you know. I see Dr. Adelizzi here has a question.
Yeah, just a comment regarding the first lecture. doctor. Ray Alizi, I've been in rheumatology practice for too long, 39 years. But in any case, I wanted to comment again. You're going to talk about lab tests in a little while. I've seen several patients now, and probably you have too, Rob, as far as that have both positive rheumatoid factor and anti-CCP, and they still don't have active rheumatoid. Of course, they make me nervous because they sound like they're high at risk for rheumatoid, but I can't find any clinical evidence of such. So again, making the point that at least right now, I wouldn't treat those patients unless there's more some sign of clinical synovitis. That's a comment.
Very good comment, and I think we all see that. And yeah, it makes you worry about these patients. And you know, with don't forget, I'll just add to that, not necessarily CCP, but with rheumatoid factors, we said in other chronic illnesses, 50% of Hep C patients get rheumatoid factors, asthma patients get it, ILD patients get it. So make sure you do a hepatitis panel on them and so forth. Of course, remember Hep C, our rheumatoid factors often associated with cryoglobulinemia and so forth. How are we doing on time? Can we take one more? We can take one more question, I guess, okay?
Thank you. So with hydroxychloroquine being first line for many of these issues, I've heard of a like total lifetime dose that you're not supposed to go over. How do you deal with that?
Do you want to say anything? Or you said hydroxychloroquine.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, now they're kind of talking like the ophthalmologists don't even get concerned about a cumulative dose until you've been on it at least 5 years. The way the Cleveland Clinic studies had gone before, you know, they say as long as we stay under 6.5 mg per kg, it should be safe. I don't know, I've had patients on it for decades, and they do very well now. That said, you know, we may start with 400 milligrams a day of hydroxychloroquine in a normal adult. After 3 to 6 months, I'll try to get them down to 200 milligrams a day. I may even have them on it every other day or 3 days a week. So it seems to be more tissue levels of the drug, I think, than actual blood levels. So there's ways you can get around that. So I've had patients on it for many years, and they've done fine as far as their eye exams are concerned. Don't forget, we learned about ocular problems with it was in Vietnam, where they were taking prophylactic doses for malaria, and they were taking like a gram a day. And so the helicopter pilots couldn't read their instrument panels at nighttime because they were illuminated in red, and it was affecting their, you know, rods and cones and affecting their color vision. That's how we learned about it, but it was much higher doses back then. Okay, I'm sorry, I'll answer your question.
It's just a comment.
Okay.
I just wanted to remark about the previous physician who said the CCP positive rheumatoid factor. I'm a rheumatologist in Tulsa. I had a patient similar to that, no joint symptoms. I thought we were rocking along, doing great. She developed eye disease, and so we had to put her on Humira.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Thank you all.